Where I'd like to start today is with the answers to the quiz that you just took on Monday. You will be getting those back Friday, so you'll have those answers in front of you to study over the weekend, because Section 2 hadn't heard yet that the exam is going to be moved to Monday, so it will not be on Friday. Since I'm making announcements, let me say a couple of things for Section 2's benefit. Hopefully you'd gotten the email message to say that you don't have to have your pre-lab done today, since you did not get confirmation until late that you were actually moving on to the next experiment. But if you've got time before lab, please do read through it. It's not a terribly complicated experiment, but at least check to see what reagents are you using, what quantities are you using. And I am going to describe what we're doing in lab today. But do try to read through that if you have a chance. And then lastly, for Section 2, you will get your exams, those of you who have not already gotten those back. You'll get those in the lab this afternoon. And you're going to also be getting lab reports. Everyone from Section 1 should have at this point gotten their paper copy back if they turned in a paper copy, or should have gotten some form of email from me related to your lab reports. And some of those went out right before lecture started, so if you haven't checked your email recently, you might want to. You are getting a message that asks you to agree to a statement on email that I described. So if you've gotten that email and you do prefer to get your comments and grade in person, just let me know. Or if you've gotten that email and you do want to get your grade by email itself, then please answer back if you have not answered already. So let's go to the quiz that we had. Allow me a moment to pull that up. Section 2, we will be discussing the test that you have gotten back. We're going to talk about free energy and entropy in lab today again, because there's one particular question that you all seem to have more difficulty with. Turning to the quiz, though, the first question was, construct a titration curve for the titration of formic acid, which is a weak acid, with sodium hydroxide. You're told that since you don't given concentrations, or not until later, the acid dissociation constant, that whatever pH marking you had on your graph could have been very approximate. It says, be sure to label the axes. And then it says, indicate on the curve where the equivalence point and the half equivalence point occur, and describe the mathematical significance of the equivalence point and the half equivalence point. So this is the titration of formic acid, which has this structure, with sodium hydroxide. That is a weak acid strong base, which is the one and only titration scenario that we've discussed so far. Now, about the pH values, what I was trying to get at there is that if you had acid and base of equal strength, and they were to neutralize each other, then yes, you're going to end up with a pH 7 solution. But in this case, because we have a weak acid and a strong base, then the equivalence point must occur above pH 7. That's fairly much the only thing I'm going to be paying attention to, since you weren't given specific concentrations or the Ka. But a weak acid, if you force it to be completely neutralized, is going to produce a salt that will react with water to remake hydroxide, because it's trying to get back into equilibrium. You can't have equilibrium if you don't have a little bit of both the acid and base forms. So remember, the assumption here that we operate under is that, yes, we think of this completely reacting. But because the salt is the product of a weak acid and a strong base, it will react with water to establish an equilibrium. Causing hydroxide to form, meaning that the neutralized solution will be basic. You weren't given a temperature, but we can assume that 7 is roughly neutral. We've already had that discussion that 7 is not always neutral. It depends on temperature. But point is, this equivalence point, where you have equal moles of acid and base react. That point is going to be above pH 7. What does the rest of the graph look like? Something roughly like this. And of course, since you were told to label your axes, it would be the volume of sodium hydroxide that you used on the x-axis, and then pH on the y-axis. That is the normal way that these are constructed. Yes?
If you didn't label pH 7, but it's obvious that it's on the upper end of the line.
If I can tell from your graph that you understood where it was supposed to be, then it is fine, yes. Now, I already indicated on here the equivalence point. And as I said over here, that is where the moles of acid reacted equals the moles of base reacted. The half equivalence point, we know where that's located on the graph if we look at the volume used to get to the equivalence point, and then we cut that volume in half. What is the mathematical significance there? There's two ways you could have answered that. One way is that the pKa of that acid is equal to the pH at that point. That's an approximation we're able to make if we have, if we're able to ignore the slight changes in concentration that occur when this does try to reestablish equilibrium. The other thing that you could say is that the concentration of the acid is equal to the concentration of the conjugate base. Now, this is an important distinction. Over here, where I said the equivalence point, that's moles acid, moles base. But just to highlight that, the acid that I'm talking about here is formic acid. The base that I'm talking about over here is sodium hydroxide. So it's the two things reacting. But where we're talking about the half equivalence point and we're trying to make some equivalence between acid and base, it's not equivalence between formic acid and sodium hydroxide. It's equivalent between formic acid and its conjugate. So let me review with a question one more time, make sure I got to all the parts of this. Draw the titration curve, label the axes. You had to somehow show me where the equivalence point occurred relatively in terms of pH. You had to indicate where the equivalence and half equivalence points are. That's what I've done here. The equivalence point is at the steepest point of the curve. Half equivalence point, again, would be at half of that volume. And then I've described what the mathematical significance of those two points is. Are there any questions on any aspects of this problem? Okay, then moving on to the sequence of questions that you had related to a buffer system. Continuing with formic acid, you're told that you're given containers of pure formic acid and pure sodium formate. Sodium formate would be the conjugate base of formic acid. You're told that formic acid has a Ka of 1.7 times 10 to negative 4. First question is, what is the composition of an ideal buffer solution containing formic acid and sodium formate? Now, you might have been initially confused because I didn't give you any molarity, but that's the point of the question, that there's many combinations as long as the moles of formic acid equal the moles of formate. That is the definition of an ideal buffer solution when you have equal quantities of an acid and its conjugate. So the ideal composition is that moles formic acid equals moles sodium formate. Exactly how many moles? Well, that determines the capacity of the buffer solution, how much acid and base it's able to resist. The next question, sub-question, is what would the pH be of this ideal buffer? Well, the pH is equal to the pKa, because that's what you have when you have equal moles of the acid and its conjugate. So again, this is our ideal buffer definition that happens to match what we get at the half equivalence point for titration. So in both of these situations, when we have that equal moles of acid and base, if we're able to use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, we end up with pH equals pKa. So it would just be the negative base 10 log of 1.7 times 10 to the negative fourth. Allow me one moment. And we get 3.77. Next sub question. Why is a buffer able to resist the effects of small quantities of a strong acid or base? It's because both the acid and its conjugate are trying to maintain an equilibrium. And as long as you don't consume all of the acid or its conjugate, it's able to maintain that equilibrium, which is why there's not much of a change in the pH. And then the last part of that question is, on the titration curve that you drew previously, circle the point that would correspond to the pH of an ideal buffer solution. And I already indicated that would be right here at that half equivalence point. Yep. As I just overheard, I was just about to draw in, that the region right around that point, which I don't think I asked for in this question, that is the buffer region. Questions? Then the last question was the calculation question. It says lactic acid can be used in combination with its conjugate base, sodium lactate, to form a buffer solution of pH 4. Given that the acid dissociation constant is 1.38 times 10 to the negative 4, calculate the mass of sodium lactate that would need to be added to 50 milliliters of a 0.1 molar solution of lactic acid in order to produce this pH 4 buffer solution. So I didn't go back and check in the notes, but I think that's either the identical problem that we worked in lecture, just changing the identities and the quantities, or it's something almost identical. So let's work through what we're given here and then figure out what we're supposed to solve and how we're supposed to solve it. So you're asked to make a buffer solution with a particular compound, and we know that the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation is the equation that we can use to estimate, in most cases, what the pH is going to be. So what is that formula? pH is equal to pKa plus log of concentration of the conjugate base over the concentration of the acid. So there are four variables here. If we're going to solve, we need to figure out what three of them are. Well, you're told the pKa of lactic acid. So Ka of lactic acid. I'm sorry, yes. Yes. It would have to say, if it's acid dissociation constant, it's always, always, always Ka. You would have to explicitly say pKa or the negative log of the constant, because the acid dissociation constant is K. Now, particularly when we get into organic chemistry, we do tend to use pKa more frequently, because there we're making qualitative comparisons. We're just using the numbers to tell what's a stronger acid, what's a stronger base. We're not doing so much in the way of calculation. But there we are always referring to pKa values.
Okay. And then are we ever going to work with a base dissociation?
That's what we're doing Friday.
Okay.
So one thing that I'm sure that you've read about if you've been reading the chapter is we've been doing everything from the perspective of an acid, but there are KBs, base dissociation constants, and we can do other problems using KB instead. But it takes so much... There's so many important points to discuss just with acids and bases, and we're so much more familiar with acids that that's why I'm doing what most people do, which is to start with acids. But we'll wrap up with bases on Friday. Was that all your question?
Yes.
Okay. No. So here I was saying that the Ka of lactic acid is 1.38 times 10 to the negative 4. So the pKa is equal to the negative base 10 log of that. And that's equal to 3.86. So that's one variable. The question tells you you want pH 4. That's another variable. So we get 4 is equal to 3.86 plus the log of this ratio of concentrations. Why don't we go ahead and solve for that ratio? That ratio is equal to 0.14. And so that means, the log of that ratio is equal to 0.14. That means the ratio itself is 10 to the 0.14, which is equal to 1.38. So rewriting the expression, that means that the concentration of HA is equal to the concentration of A minus divided by 1.38, or A is equal to 1.38 times concentration of HA. Yes? Let's see, did I leave a negative out somewhere? 4 and 3.86? No, because 4 minus 3.86 is positive 0.14. That's if we're doing pH or something like that, because it's got a negative in the definition of pH. Here we just got a plain old log, though. So it's a positive log, so no, you don't put the negative in there in this case. No, but that's an important point in that. Oh, I better watch out for that when I'm grading. You might be used to putting that negative in because that's what you do when you do pH or pKa, but this is not directly one of those calculations, so we don't need the negative in that case. All right, now, if the concentration ratio is this, this is also the ratio of the number of moles because you're in a common solution. So if we can figure out the number of moles of the acid, that's going to let us get the number of moles of the conjugate base, which is exactly what the problem's asking for, isn't it? Yes, calculate the mass of sodium lactate. So what are we given? That we have 50 milliliters of a 0.1 molar solution of lactic acid. And so that means we have 500 milliliters, then it would be 0.05 moles. So this is 0.0050 moles lactic acid. So the mass of sodium lactate will equal 1.38 times that number of moles, because that's the ratio that we already established, and then times the molar mass, which I'll fill those numbers in later, give us an actual number. Yes?
All right. Can you break down, like, why you multiply by the moles of lactic acid?
Yes, because what we saw for in the equation up above here was a ratio.
Okay.
So
ratio of, like,
of the acid and the conjugate. So that's this part of the equation.
Okay.
And we could go through and calculate concentration for HA. Actually, the concentration is given to us here. But what we're looking for is that ratio. And instead of just concentration, we do need moles, because the question is asking for the mass of the salt that we need to add in. But whether it's concentration or moles, the ratio is the same, because it's one solution in one container. So we know that there's 1.38 more of the base than the acid. That hopefully would make some sense, like one quick spot check we could do to see if our logic is good, is if the buffer solution, the ideal buffer solution, has a pH of 3.86, but we want something that's more basic because it's got a larger pH, then there should be more of that conjugate base around than the acid. So it makes sense that we have a little bit more here, and that's what that ratio gives us. Once we have the ratio, as I said, instead of just finding concentration, we need moles. So we take the moles of lactic acid, because that's HA, multiply it by this ratio. That gives us the moles of sodium lactate. And then there's just the molar mass to deal with.
Okay. So you multiply moles by the ratio,
and then because I asked for grams, not moles, that's why we need the molar mass.
So are you going to use the 0.1 molar?
No, not in this case. Well, we did. We used the 0.1 molar right here. And maybe I got to stop doing these kinds of mental math things in my head, because it is 0.100 times 0.050 that gives us this 0.005 moles. I'm just bad about doing that in my head, because I don't use calculators except for really difficult problems, so I'm used to doing that. Right? Because moles is equal to concentration times volume. So all I did was multiply these two numbers together. So yes, we did use the 0.1 molar. Another way to say it is, sure, you could have put the 0.1 molar in here, solve for the concentration of lactate, but then you'd still have to multiply by volume to get moles. So whether we multiply volume by before or after, you have to do it somewhere.
Thank you.
No, sure. Does anyone else have any, even what you think might be, let me say this carefully. There aren't really stupid questions if it's something that you don't know and honestly want an answer to. So even if you think someone else might think the question is silly, I bet you there's someone else in the classroom that's confused about the same thing. So does anyone have any other questions about this type of calculation? Okay, so that was the last question on the quiz. Question though, yes. 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 The where did I put that here? Ideal composition, the moles are equal.
So the ideal composition is when the buffer is half.
Which is the same thing as saying that the acid is in the same moles as its conjugate. Yes. Yes, you could. So the question here is, there's two things. The point was brought up, isn't this point on the buffer region where we have that ideal buffer solution? And yes, it is. And that's why I tried to tie these two ideas together, that the mathematical significance of the half equivalence point is we have equal quantities of the acid and its conjugate base, and that an ideal buffer solution is one where we have equal moles. The question is now being asked, well, could we say down here, in the same way that I wrote it up here, that it's not just the moles that are equal, but it's the concentration that is equal? And the answer is yes, because again, you're in one solution with the same volume. So if the moles are the same, the concentration's automatically the same. You could write concentration equal, or you could write moles equal. What you could not write is mass. Any other questions on this particular problem? Okay, then, boy, there's several. Yes?
So I was looking at the notes.
Yes. Yes. Oh, okay, let's talk about that.
Okay.
All right, no, because that's one of the many small topics still left in the chapter. So I'm going to answer that by talking about titration again, because let's look at the titration of polyprotic acids. Have you all had in your Chem 1B or Chem 1A class the terms monoprotic, diprotic, polyprotic? Would anybody like a review of the terms? Yes. So, monoprotic means it dissociates into only one available H+. Di, tri, poly means two, three, and many. So diprotic means you dissociate into two H+. Triprotic means three H+. Polyprotic is a general term meaning more than one. So examples of polyprotic acids, some very common ones, sulfuric acid, which gives off two, phosphoric acid, which gives off three, carbonic acid, which gives off two. So we can write two different dissociations for carbonic acid, for example. There's this dissociation, where it makes hydrogen carbonate or bicarbonate, and then there's another dissociation where you make the second H+, plus now you have carbonate. Each one of these has its own separate equilibrium constant. And generally, the first proton that comes off is given the value of Ka1, and the second one that comes off is Ka2. Now, let me look this up in the book, because if we're going to make a titration curve, I need to actually know what these Ka values are. So carbonic acid carbonic, there we are. 4.5 times 10 to the negative 7 for the first one, and then 4.7 times 10 to the negative 11 for the second one. Since we're going to need those later, let me calculate what pKa1 and pKa2 would be. So pKa1, that Ka value was 4.5 times 10 to the negative 7, which means that the Ka value, or pKa value, is 6.35. Then if the second one is 4.7 times 10 to the negative 11th, then that means its pKa is 10.33. Now, these equilibrium constants are different from each other. The first one is bigger than the second one, which should make intuitive sense. Why would it normally be the case that the first proton that comes off has a higher acid dissociation constant than the second one? But why? But there's a specific reason why. Everything you said is correct, but there's a fundamental reason that's causing this. What is the charge on carbonic acid? Zero, right? What's the charge on bicarbonate? Minus one. Does it make sense that an H plus likes to come off of something that's already minus charged? Because something that's already minus charge, wouldn't that want to react with an H plus? Well, to some extent, yes. But that's the difference between these two constants. You take a neutral compound, pull a hydrogen off, you make a negative ion, which means it's even harder to pull that second proton off. And then you make it more negative, which makes it then even harder to pull the next hydrogen off. It's a little bit like ionization energy. First electron that you remove from an atom has a certain energy cost to it. Since you've already got that positive charged atom, to take yet another negative away, higher energy. Opposite charges, same kind of story. So, the first dissociation of an acid is usually stronger than the second. Because once the first proton, the first H plus, is removed, an anion is generated. And just as a commentary, the negative and positive charges would tend to attract. Now, where this discussion of Ka1 and Ka2 came up with was when I was doing a problem where we had carbonate as a buffer. And in that problem, since we had a bicarbonate-carbonate buffer system, that's why it was pKa2 that was used, because we're looking at the hydrogen from this bicarbonate coming off. We wouldn't use any of the information from Ka1, because if you're getting to carbonate, the dissociation's already happened. Am I making any sense at all? Here's a type of problem I could give you. Exactly like this. I say, okay, you've got this bicarbonate-carbonate mixture, and then I give you two pKa values. How do you know which one to use? That's the point. The first one only relates carbonic acid and bicarbonate. Is carbonic acid involved in this problem? So you wouldn't look at it because it's not influencing that buffer system. To try to trick you. No, well, they give you the information because maybe if you wanted something that was a lower pH, well, okay, you can't use a carbonic acid bicarbonate buffer mixture because carbonic acid just decomposes. But assuming that it didn't decompose, like the same story is true for phosphoric acid, monosodium hydrogen phosphate, disodium hydrogen phosphate, and then sodium phosphate. In other words, take one hydrogen off, the second one, and the third one. each of those has a different dissociation constant. Which constant you use in a problem depends on which compounds you care about. And so if, like in this case, we were using carbonic acid and bicarbonate, then we would use carbonic acid's Ka value because it's got the proton that's hopping around. But in our problem, we used bicarbonate carbonate, and it was the hydrogen from bicarbonate that was coming off, and that's why we used Ka2. So what I'm avoiding talking about, what you're asking about, is what's known as simultaneous equilibrium, which that's one of the things we'll get into on Friday. But I want to try to ease into it by first talking about these polyprotic systems. But you're asking perfectly valid questions. Now, for everybody else, did you follow the question that was going on here? Why did we use a particular Ka value when multiple ones are given? And it depends on the system used. And so that's what, this seems like a small statement, but that's what we've been talking about the last couple of minutes. That if you have this mixture of bicarbonate and carbonic acid, then pKa2 is used because it describes the strength of the H+ that will dissociate from the thing in our buffer solution, the bicarbonate. Now, we will talk some more about this, but let's get to that titration curve. Because what does a titration curve look like for something that's got two hydrogens that come off? It has an extra hill, you could say, in the diagram. We go through these two points where the slope becomes the greatest because that's where the pH is changing the greatest because it is the two different equivalence points. So this first equivalence point would be the moles of carbonic acid being equal to the moles of hydroxide, let's say. But that only pulls off one proton. So then the next would be where the moles of bicarbonate that now react are equal to the moles of sodium hydroxide. Those are the two equivalence points. If we have two different equivalence points, we're going to have two different half equivalence points. Where we get halfway to this stoichiometric goal. So if we're trying to react just the first H+, equivalence point is where we've completed it. The first half equivalence point is where we're halfway there. And that is where the concentration of carbonic acid is equal to the concentration of hydrogen carbonate. Up top here, we would then have the half equivalence point number 2, which is where now the bicarbonate concentration equals the carbonate concentration. Because I have pKa values that I got from the Ka values, I know that these half equivalence points are going to occur at 6.35 and 10.33. So this is what a diprotic acid titration curve would look like. Really, it's just two titration curves combined into one. And I guess I should introduce this term because it applies to bicarbonate. A question first, yes?
When we'll talk
Yes. Yes, it is.
Then why is the energy for the first dissociation stronger than the second?
Energy.
You said the first dissociation of the acid is really stronger than the second?
Yes, and it is, because 10 to the negative 7th is bigger than 10 to the negative 14th. How does it relate to what, I'm sorry? How do these values relate to it?
Yeah, because you said it's harder to get the second proton out of the iron, right?
Right.
Shouldn't that mean the second dissociation, shouldn't that be bigger than the first value?
It releases less energy.
Well, so the delta G, which is energy, would be related to K. So the first dissociation there has a less positive delta G than the second one. Less positive means more spontaneous. So it might be bigger energy for the second one, bigger positive energy, which means it's less favorable. So I think you're maybe getting tripped up by the negative sign that relates equilibrium constants and free energy. Greater positive free energy is less and less favorable, less and less dissociation. Is that making sense now? Okay. Now, let's see. We were talking about, amphoteric. So the only other word, only other words I can think with this ampho prefix, amphibian and amphitheater. What is an amphibian? Both what?
Land and sea.
Amphibian lives in two different environments. Amphitheater. It's an outdoor-indoor theater. It serves two purposes. That's what amphi means, to have a dual nature. Amphoteric means a compound that can act as both an acid and a base. There's many examples, including bicarbonate. React bicarbonate with acid, you get carbonic acid. React bicarbonate with base, you get carbonate. What's some other examples? Well, the hydrogen sulfate ion, the dihydrogen phosphate ion, and water. Because water can become protonated to make this fake thing called the hydronium ion. There is no really an H3O plus molecule. I forget what it is now, but something like 15 to 18 water molecules surrounding an H+, and that whole unit is really what H+ is. But point is, water can be protonated. Of course, water can have the hydrogen ripped off to become hydroxide. So water is amphoteric. Yes?
So the titration curve was for a diprotic acid, right?
This is a diprotic acid, yes.
What exactly is that?
Means that two hydrogens are able to come off. So that's what this terminology up here was that we were defining. So monoprotic would be something like HCl, where you can only have one H plus that comes off. Yes?
So like the ones that we did so far before this would be...
Well, all monoprotic titration curves, that's right. So, yes, continue.
So the first curve is for the first H plus that comes off?
That's right.
The
first hill here is for the first part of that titration, yes, and then the second one is for the second part of that titration. That's right. All right. We not have much time left, so let me see. I know one more type of buffer solution problem I want to start working on. If we don't finish today, that's okay. Because I might have scared you all or misled you all by all that discussion of KAs and ice problems that we did. The ice problems really are more for Chem 1B, I have to admit, because that's where you're first learning how to solve these problems. But part of the whole point of this chapter is that there is this thing called the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation that normally we can use for buffer systems. I'm not going to repeat the story today, but it is in the notes in the past. When we can use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation and when we can't. And it's the same, it's under the same conditions as to when we can simplify ICE problems. So I went through ICE problems just to review how they work and to talk about acid-base chemistry a little bit, and then linked that to the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. Well, we can get past that and accept that, yes, for buffer solutions, the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation normally can be used. How can we use that to answer some of these same buffer problems that I started this whole chapter out with? So in other words, if we had, let's say, an ideal buffer solution of, oh, let's find a new acid to play with here. Oh, why not? Hypochlorous acid. Bleach, in other words. It's got a Ka of 2.9 times 10 to the negative 8th. Without pulling a calculator out, very, very approximately, what is the pH of the ideal buffer solution made out of this? 8. How do you know that? Because it's going to be negative log of Ka, and you've got 10 to the negative 8 here. Well, negative log of 10 to the negative 8 is 8. So since this is actually a little bit bigger than that value, that means that the pKa is going to be a little tiny bit smaller, so it's going to be maybe around 7.7, 7.8 or something like that. But you know it's roughly 8 based off of that exponent. Let's say I wanted a solution that was exactly pH 8, or no, that's a different problem. Let's say I had an ideal solution where maybe it was a pretty concentrated buffer solution. Given a solution of 0.5 molar hypochlorous acid and 0.5 molar sodium hypochlorite, what would the pH of the solution be if 10 milliliters of 8.0 molar hydrochloric acid were added to 1 liter of the buffer? Maybe this is an excellent problem to send you home with to work on so we can discuss the answer on Friday. Yes?
70.0 milliliters.
Or, and that's a bad one. Let's try that again. 10.0 milliliters of an 8 molar hydrochloric acid solution. Now, I've been known, as I tend to get more familiar with a class, to ask people to come up and solve problems for us. And I'm usually pretty good at spotting in the audience the people that are looking at me the least. Those are the people that least want to answer the question, and so those are the people I tend to go for. Not to embarrass any of you necessarily, but you know, all of you in theory are going to go up for job interviews, and so when you get up in front of that person that's interviewing you, it's not like, well, I don't want to answer that question. No, you got to answer all their questions, so you got to be able to talk on your feet. So maybe work on this problem tonight and we'll solve it on Friday.